You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 23.
What are the things that people actually talk about at a venue? Really, we want to be able to answer, like, fill in the blank of this place has X, and where X is something that's very interesting that we want to be able to surface to those users. And so X, most of the time, turns into a noun phrase.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. I love laying down the law and Bayesian statistics the last couple of weeks. Really dug deep in there, fighting the good fight. You know, I haven't been trolling for five-star reviews lately. I'm on episode 23 now. Prime number. It's a special occasion. It's also Amazon Prime Day, so that's a coincidence. So if you're liking this show, please go to iTunes or alternatively SoundCloud, Stitcher. Leave a five-star review. It's really helping me get this thing off the ground. It's a very easy thing you could do. Also looking forward to hearing your feedback and show ideas. localmaxradio@gmail.com is where you send your letters, your correspondence, your thoughts. Great hearing from you. All right. So today we're going to talk about natural language processing, something that we call Tastes in Foursquare, kind of the crown jewel of our recommendation engine, and our approach to translation and getting city guide recommendations to work across borders, language, and various cultures. So for those of you who haven't been listening to the other episodes, the Foursquare City Guide is the app that you can get on your smartphone, but also on the web at foursquare.com, where you can search for all of the best places worldwide. That's restaurants, bars, parks, museums, any sort of quirky place that you can find around cities and towns. Now, you might say that you have another app for that. Believe me, I've heard it. But no application takes its approach to recommendations quite like Foursquare does. And I think if you listen to my discussion with Chris today, you'll begin to understand why. Now, look, we've spoken about internationalization on The Local Maximum before. You know, way back in episode 2, I interviewed Mariam Ali about the whole host of issues in internationalization and localization. In that episode, we were talking about how to build apps that work in different languages and in different cultures and all sorts of the issues that come up. But, you know, in that case, we were talking mostly about the text that appears in the app, text that we write, text that we call copy. So, for example, there's a screen on our app Swarm with a House of Cards reference, a House of Cards joke. You know, they don't watch House of Cards in other countries, so got to change that. And also all the translations and stuff. But now today, we're expanding to talk about text that people write, you know, average everyday people like me and you, that we have no control over. User-generated reviews. They're called Foursquare tips. And now instead of a dozen languages, well, we detect 97. So as you can imagine, you know, we needed some real firepower in natural language processing, natural language understanding, and we needed an engineering team to build out some of the logic that connects concepts, specifically what we call tastes, to other tastes and to languages around the world so that you have the best local experience wherever you go. Now, one of the main people providing that NLP and engineering firepower is Chris Conception. Chris originally studied computer science at Columbia, where he focused on natural language processing as he got his master's degree. Then he spent 14 years working for government contractors dealing with various AI and NLP problems. His last 4.5 years have been at Foursquare. He maintains our language stack and works on both our consumer and enterprise products. This, of course, includes our core venue search technology. So we're going to find out from Chris Conception today some background on NLP, some of the ways we interpret our Foursquare text, and maybe a glimpse of the secret sauce that is Foursquare tastes. All right, Chris, welcome to the program. Welcome to The Local Maximum.
Thank you.
I'm really glad to have you on the show today. We're going to talk about natural language processing, and we're going to talk about something that we have at Foursquare called Tastes, which is a really cool system that I don't think anyone else has. It's really uncommon. But let's start a little bit about natural language processing, because your work in that goes back quite a few years. So tell us, like, what initially got you interested in natural language processing? And also, what is natural language processing? Let's define it.
Sure. So, a long time ago, back when I was an undergrad, I was a computer science major and, was taking all the generic systems track courses. But I had some friends who ended up going into grad school for natural language processing, who were like a year ahead of me. I was working on projects with them, and they were explaining like, oh yes, we're going to work with this professor at Columbia. Her name is Kathy McEwen. She's a very well respected person in the field, and they were going to go do their PhDs. And so I spent my senior year. I was like, oh, I should take let me take a class in this and see what's going on. That really is what sparked the interest. I also went on to grad school, and I also decided to study under Kathy. I was in grad school for 2 years working in Kathy's NLP group, and ended up moving out to DC, taking on applied research and development jobs for the government, but using specifically like working specifically within the AI NLP domain. More to the point of like, what does it mean when you say NLP? So NLP stands for natural language processing. The idea behind it is that you have electronic text and you want the computer to try to understand things about that text. So there are any number of low-level things that you may want to know about the text, such as like what's the language it's written in, what's the script it's written in, what are the sentences within that text, and then there are higher-level concepts that you would probably want a computer to try to take a stab at, as like, okay, you have a news story. Tell me what this news story. Summarize this news story for me, or who are the people that are talked about in this news story. And so you really need to like NLP corresponds to like a whole host of technologies, but it's really about like trying to make sense and understand electronic data.
Right. And so when you were starting to get into NLP as an undergrad and as a grad student, were there any applications that you remember, early on where you were like, wow, this is really cool. This is a really powerful thing. Like any programs that you saw through your advisor or through your classes or something like that?
Certainly the summarization work that Kathy was doing back in the mid to late 90s was really cool for me, because it was just like, wow, like I'd never seen, because so we're talking, it's like 95, 96, right? Yeah. The internet had just been born. Like I was still using like the NCSA browser and there just wasn't a lot. I hadn't had a lot of exposure to technology other than like an Apple IIe and programming in BASIC, and to be able to see like a program take a news story and produce a summary from of that news story was just mind blowing to me. And so that's really to me, that was the first moment that I was just like, wow, this is a really cool and interesting thing, and I would like to know more about it.
Yeah, I think it's a similar to me. When I got my interest in machine learning, where it was like, okay, it's doing something where it's not immediately clear, how I should be programming this. Like if I wanted to implement a spreadsheet program and I wanted to implement a formula, it's like, okay, I see how the formula maps to machine language. That's fine. But when it comes to summarizing text, it's just so open-ended.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, when you think about how a human does these things, like it seems very
automatic.
It seems very natural, right? Yeah. Like you're just reading the document and you kind of understand it. But like computers are such low level things. Like how do you tell a computer to understand and resolve things like pronouns things along those lines? So it's
yeah. So there's two terms that I want to kind of disambiguate a little bit. There's natural language processing. And these days, you see a lot of people talking about natural language understanding, either when they're describing their technology or when they're describing their job. I mean, maybe it's a little bit of flourish sometimes, but what in your mind is the difference between when someone says they're doing natural language processing versus natural language
understanding? Sure. And again, NLP just is this really large umbrella term, and it can refer, like, people, when people say NLP, they can be referring to anything along the lines of like machine translation or, ontology work, or natural language understanding. And, you know, by natural language understanding, I'm talking mainly about understanding the high-level concepts within the document. And this would involve things along the lines of, like, coreference resolution, anaphora resolution, or named entity tagging. Like, you just need to know, you need to be able to answer questions, you know, typically like the who, what, when, where, how, and why. And, like, you have to have, you know, like, NLU is focused on trying to be able to identify and fill in those questions.
Is natural language understanding related to automatic translation at all? Because it seems like if you wanted to translate the text, it'd be helpful to understand it first. Or are most translation systems like non-understanding?
Well, so there's been a lot of work in machine translation. When I first started in grad school, a lot of the work was focused on using language models. So they were doing things along the lines of looking for phrases and looking at parallel corpora, taking phrases and trying to match them up and create a translation out of them using frequently co-occurring n-grams across languages. I think I want to say like in the 2000s, things moved into like a purely statistical method where you had things like the Moses transducer. I forget what it was called, but it basically was just a machine learning algorithm that would treat the parallel corpora as just bag words. And attempt to do the translations that way, just purely off of math. And I believe like the state of the art these days is probably a hybrid. I'm pretty sure Google Translate uses both language models and statistics on the back end to get there. Because again, you really want to be able to smooth those translations at the end of the day so that they are human readable. That was really the biggest complaint about machine translation, was that the end translation was always so stilted and didn't sound very natural.
You can get the gist of it.
Yes,
often,
but
you know, if you wanted to make a respectable website, you know, and you wanted it to be, you know, because oftentimes you go and you're like, oh, I know this is a translation.
Yeah.
And as we'll talk a little bit more about translation at Foursquare in a minute, because we do have some interesting examples. But let's go back to our NLP pipeline at Foursquare, because that's something that we have a whole pipeline of natural language processing that is done on all of the text that comes in through our consumer applications. So that's Swarm. When you check into a place, you add some text. In Foursquare, when you add the city guide, when you add tips to a place, that's usually a few sentences of text. And there's a lot of it. And so we've done a lot of work on that. I think I don't want to be presumptuous, but I think you and I have done the most work on the NLP pipeline of anyone in the company.
Yeah.
It's probably been a few years since I've touched it, but I think I remember it pretty well. The culmination, almost the culmination of the pipeline, there's a lot of stuff we've talked about in the pipeline. Sentiment analysis we've talked about on this program before, episode 3, I'll link back to that. But one of the culminations is something called tastes that we have in Foursquare, and that's actually something that you can see in the final design of the app. So tell us, what is a taste as you see it?
When we were coming up with the concept of tastes, we really wanted to be able to produce a feature where we'd be able to encapsulate what are the things that people actually talk about at a venue? Like, what are the specific things? What are these descriptions of things? Really, we want to be able to answer, like, fill in the blank of this place has X, and where X is something that's very interesting that we want to be able to surface to those users. And so at the end of the day, X most of the time turns into a noun phrase. And so for things like, and so by a noun phrase, I mean, in English, I would mean like an adjective plus a noun. So an example would be a chicken sandwich, right? In that instance, the chicken sandwich.
Good chicken sandwiches here in the city.
There are, but both words are nouns, but you can imagine that people talk about spicy chicken sandwich. Spicy is an adjective, but that would also be considered a taste. One of the things that we didn't want to get into were tastes that had sentiment or superlative adjectives were kind of thrown out. Like, we didn't really care about great burgers. We cared about cheeseburgers.
Right. We already handled great burgers on the sentiment side.
Right.
So we didn't want to deal with that. It's actually interesting. So before we had the taste system, we had something called SIPs, Statistically Improbable Phrases. That was in the version of Foursquare in 2018, which I implemented and basically would highlight text that a lot of people are talking about at a place. But it was totally ignorant of any of the part of speech or noun phrases or any of that. So it would, the highlight would be like, it could say spicy chicken sandwich is great. And it would just be, the highlight might be sandwich is great.
Yep.
Or sandwich is. And I had to implement a lot of rules like, okay, don't end it with a verb or something like that. Like is, I banned the word is, like things like that. There are all these rules which sort of made it complicated. And so this was sort of the clean version where we actually figured out what was going on at these places. And it was always fun to, like, I remember being online at the bagel shop and like looking over someone's shoulders and seeing them check the sips. Hasn't happened too recently. I wish you'd see that more often. So,
well, and you know, honestly, like SIPs were a good idea, and they in fact made it into tastes. Like, because for instance, there was an example of a SIP that we ended up turning into a taste was something along the lines of, I think there's like a bowling alley where like a bunch of the tips were talking about Joe the bartender. And like the SIP was Joe the bartender.
Right.
And while like we would never want to create a Joe the bartender taste because it's not an actual thing. It's not a thing that you can like. It's not a thing that actually would exist on any other venue besides this one particular venue.
Yeah, because usually when you like a taste, it's like, I like Joe the bartender. I want to visit other places with Joe the bartender.
Right. Like that,
unless he works at several places, it's not going to work out.
Right. So what we ended up doing was we took all the SIPs that were found and we smoothed those down using the part of speech tags within the tips to figure out what the noun phrase was for within the SIP. And then would turn that sip into something we call a sip taste. And so the sip tastes actually made their way into, they appear as tastes, but on the back end, they're not in the ontology in any way.
All right, so let's go through real quickly how we generate those tastes. Now, you can do some self-personalization in Foursquare and Marsbot, by the way, by telling it which tastes you like. Marsbot is down this week, by the way. Maybe by the time we'll get it back up by the time it's in. Did you know this? Marsbot is down.
Oh no.
Oh, it's terrible. We'll get it back up. It's the credit card we were using for Twilio expired.
Oh, it's always money.
Yeah. No, my code is fine. I was able to go into my script and figure out what it was in like 30 minutes. So I just did that actually before this. Anyway, where were we? I don't know if I'm going to include that in. Okay. So, yes, you could tell our city guide which tastes you like, and we make it personalized, but the trick is figuring out which places have which tastes. So maybe you could take us through kind of the different steps of the pipeline and how we go from raw text to the tastes.
Sure. So there's actually like a two-phase process here. So the first phase when we were developing this was we had to pull the tastes out and actually make an ontology of all of the tastes that existed within a given language. Because, Foursquare supports, I think it's like 11 or 12 different languages, and each of those languages would have their own specific taste model. And then, the idea was like, how do we actually figure out what the tastes are in each of these languages? So what we ended up doing was making use of the part of speech tags and the shallow parser that we had put into place within the NLP stack. We're able to find instances of noun phrases that occurred, above a certain threshold within that language's corpus of tips. And if we saw it happen frequently enough, we would then flag it as a candidate taste, And then we would have Crowdflower users that they would take instructions. So like we would have a whole host of instructions as to what is a taste and what isn't a taste. And we would give them, you know, examples of the text within a tip. And they would go through and say yes or no to whether or not these strings were tastes or not. And so that's how we bootstrapped the system for all of the languages, the tastes within the languages. Once we actually have all the tastes flagged and put into an ontology, and we'll talk about the ontology later.
Yeah.
The next step then is to take all of those tastes and then rip over all of the text that we have and flag the tastes, you know, that have been approved within that text. So that you know that, you know, a tip that's talking about the bacon cheeseburger, you'll have the appropriate bacon cheeseburger taste, taste ID associated with that particular tip. And then you can associate that taste ID with the venue as well. And that helps explore, like, our search functionality, be able to, you know, pull back the appropriate venues based off of the tastes that that are attached to them.
I just remembered that I remember thinking about this. Did we ever do something where you mentioned, like, people mentioned that a place doesn't have something? I remember we
had do. There is some negation logic within yeah. there. So we actually, I believe
that's sophisticated. People don't realize this. If I say this place has no Wi-Fi, we're actually smart enough sometimes to know what that yep. means.
So what ends up happening under the hood is that every taste that's associated with a venue has an affinity score to that venue. In the event that a taste has been negated within the tip, that affinity score is negated as well. And so if you have a bunch of people saying, oh, there's no coffee here or there's no Wi-Fi mm-hmm. here, we would know that we would have a negative affinity of coffee and Wi-Fi to a particular venue because we knew that people were saying that it actually wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah. So there were a few challenges when we were building up this pipeline. One was language detection, which was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be, mainly because our texts were so short. But another one that you've mentioned before is Turkish as a language is sort of hard, particularly in, is it tokenization or normalization? Tell us what was the issue we ran around that, because we do have a lot of Turkish users.
Sure. Turkish is a very challenging language. The main reason it's challenging is that there just isn't a lot of data. Not a lot of tag data, marked up data to train models off of. The other problem with Turkish is that it's what is called an agglutinative language. What that means is that you have a base word and you can have any number of suffixes that then can be attached to that word, which will then add additional context to that word. So what you could end up having is a base word with like six different suffixes attached to it that basically would translate into almost a complete sentence by itself. And so any sort of morphological analyzer that's going to attack an agglutinative language needs to be able to pick those suffixes off in a smart way and also be able to understand what those suffixes are actually doing to the base words. And so Turkish is, I think, probably the hardest language that we actually technically support, mainly because it is so morphologically rich. And so what we ended up having to do was I had to make some tough choices because we didn't have a lot of marked up data to train models off of. So we basically just took a morphological dictionary on the back end. And because we really only cared about noun phrases, we were really biased the dictionary to find nouns more so than verbs or adverbs or things along those lines.
We didn't have to build an entire grammatical parser or an entire NLU system, really.
Most of the time, the things that we cared about were noun phrases.
Right.
And in that instance, what we really wanted to be able to do is, given some text, we want to be able to find the nouns within that text. A lot of times those nouns could be talking about, person names, and that's fine as long as we're able to identify that. In English, you're able to pick apart proper names by capitalization. I think capitalization also happens within Turkish as well. So it's, I think those are, good ways of being able to mark that up. And I believe the dictionary actually does a good job of marking up what it thinks are proper nouns as well.
Yeah. So you have listed here, you sent me a list of other issues that we came across insofar as language detection and tokenization. Tell me what some of those were.
Oh, sure. So, I mean, tokenization, typically, you can think in English, like making tokens in English is for the most part really easy, right? Like we have...
A token is a word.
A word is, yeah, right, exactly. A token is a word. Although that's not always true within English because you can think of contractions, right?
Like
D-O-N apostrophe T, that's actually two words. And so when you tokenize that, what should you do? Should it be do and then N apostrophe T is two separate tokens? Should it be a single token because it is a single word, but it conceptually represents two words? Like these are all choices that have to be made by the tokenizer. But again, like tokenization becomes more of a problem when you don't actually have those word boundaries. And so a language like Chinese, it's an open research problem on doing word segmentation within Chinese because there are no word boundaries. And in fact, it's up to the human reader to take, a sequence of sequence of characters and be able to segment where the word boundaries actually exist within that string. Humans are able to do it. Machines, it's a harder thing for machines to be able to do.
Right. Certainly a lot harder than English. And then also we have some language detection problems. You talk here about Russian versus Ukrainian.
So language detection, for the most part, it's really good. Like the Google has what's called, I think, the Chrome language detector. I think they're on the version maybe 2, maybe even 3. I'm not even sure. I think it's 2 that they're up to. And like they get like 90-something percent, 95-96% accuracy for language detection. But the trick there is that a lot of these language detectors use what's called a trigram model. Like they're basically just looking at three characters at a time, and then figuring out how often you see those three characters within a given language based off of the training data that you have. And so a lot of times you're performing this language detection on large pieces of text, like a news article or something along those lines. Like the challenge that we have at Foursquare is that people can sometimes not write very long tips, and specifically for shouts. Like, for instance, if you were to check into a Mexican restaurant and you were to just say tacos, like that word by itself is both a Spanish word and it's an English, it's a loan word that exists within English. So how should you actually mark that, for language detection purposes?
Yeah, there's some ambiguity there. And also, so we supplement those character engrams with dictionaries, right?
So, we did that for a while. And if you recall, we actually had the problem of, tips that were in multiple languages were causing, English, demonstrably like Hebrew tips to be marked as English because the training data that we had, we were marking up a tip or several tips that had both English and Hebrew in it as English. And so anytime it would see Hebrew characters, that dictionary tool would say,
and then put it in the
yes. English. Yeah. So what we end up doing now is for every user, we actually create a language model on a per user basis based off of the data that they actually produce.
Yeah, the one example that came up today that was challenging because we went to somebody was talking about NLP in Arabic, and a few years ago I remember we were detecting languages of tips, and we like to see how many tips we have in how many languages, and we noticed hey, there's a bunch of tips that are tagged as Somali in our set, and I was very skeptical of that. We do have Foursquare tips in Somalia. You can go to restaurants in Somalia and get Foursquare tips, but they're not in Somali. They're either in English or Arabic or something. It turned out that tips that were Arabic transliterated into Latin characters were being marked as Somali. Yeah. So that was a really interesting issue. Another one I see here is Galician, which I don't think there are any tips in that language,
idea is that like it's based off of the training data of the language detector. Like Galician and Portuguese are very, very similar to each other, and so when you have short Portuguese text, it can look very similar to Galician, and so that's why we would end up having a lot of tips being marked as Galician when in reality they were just Portuguese.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to tastes because. Tastes, they form an ontology. Sometimes I call it a lattice. It's not really a lattice. A lattice is something that you can and or, but oftentimes you can, take We have super tastes. We have subtastes. So tell us about the different relationships between the tastes.
Sure. There are two main relationships in the ontology. We have what's called an equivalence, and we have what's called an implication. Equivalences are for things like cheeseburger with no space and cheese space burger. Like, you would want those two to be morally equivalent to each other. In fact, we would pick a canonical version of that, and I believe it's actually cheeseburger with no space. I think is the canonical version of that taste. And so everything that has an equivalence relationship can be tagged within the tips based off of how they appear, but they would be marked with the canonical version of the taste. Another example of equivalence that isn't necessarily just like a typo or spacing would be shrimp and prawns. They both, they're two words that refer to the same, in English, refer to the same thing. And so you would want them to, conceptually be marked with the same taste ID, such that when you were to search for shrimp, if you had a venue where people were only talking about prawns, you would still be able to get that venue back.
So I think for those in my audience who are mathematically inclined, we can say maybe lattice was too much. I want to say partially ordered set, right? So you have sub items, and you have, well, a super item is just the reverse of a sub item, and it's transitive, right? Meaning that you have bacon cheeseburger implies cheeseburger implies burger, or bacon cheeseburger implies cheeseburger, cheeseburger implies burger, therefore bacon cheeseburger implies burger. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. So like in the instances where and so that's you're talking about the actual implication relationship.
Yeah.
And yes, that is 100% correct. We actually have the implications are so you were talking about more of a subphrase analysis in that instance. So bacon cheeseburger, so the bacon cheeseburger taste would also imply bacon. It would imply cheese. It would imply cheeseburger. All those subphrase components of bacon cheeseburger are first class tastes, and so they would all be implied. But you also have more like higher concept implications. So things like French toast is implying breakfast. Those are harder. Like a lot of like the subphrase implications can be found automatically. The higher level ones, we had to do a little bit of extra work on along that.
Was that again crowd flour?
So what ended up happening was we made use of a lot of the menu. The menu data that we have.
Yeah.
So we have structure within the menus such that we know when things are labeled under breakfast or lunch or dinner. So definitely for the mealtime intentions, we were able to populate the implications based off of the mealtime intentions using the menus. So if we saw a taste appearing in the section of the breakfast section enough times, we were able to automatically propose that French toast should imply breakfast. And we would then have a human be able to go through and just say yes or no to the proposal. And that human was on our side. So that was like we had interns going through that, or the PMs themselves would do that.
Right. And now tell me about the egg roll problem, because this is, there's always something in NLP. Anything you do in NLP, there's always something, right?
Yes, there is always something. So as I mentioned, you can automatically do those subphrase implications. And for the bacon cheeseburger example, it works. Bacon cheeseburger does imply bacon, it implies cheese, and it implies burger. Like all of those things are present. However, if you have a taste like egg roll should not imply egg, nor should it imply rolls. Rolls would be, things like sushi rolls. Eggs are, just not a part of an egg roll. And so we would have to, we would find these crazy cases those implications were just, I think, automatically ingested, and then we would see these crazy results in the beta version or the internal version of the app that we were using. Another fun example was, another issue is homonyms. Homonyms also posed a particular challenge. So you had things like wings, for instance. When we were thinking of wings, when we made the taste wings, we were talking about chicken wings.
Yeah, of course.
And the what ended up happening was we were like, okay, wings are a taste, get it in there, get it tagged. And then we found that the best places to go for wings were museums, because yeah, people keep talking about the art wing or the statue wing. And so we had to blacklist, we had to do category blacklists of museums for that particular taste, because you just, you know, it's the same word. It just means, you know, it has a different word sense.
Yeah, I think we had a problem in Marsbot when there was like, hey, welcome to Central Parks, try the trails, yum. Actually, that wasn't a taste problem. That was more like it was just being tagged as food. So maybe not relevant. Okay, so all of this is great for a single language. You could do this, you could copy this over for any language you want. But we decided to go one step further and start making connections between the taste graphs of the multiple languages. So why did we decide to do this? What sort of features were we building into our recommendation that made us decide to do this? And then we'll get into what the challenges were.
Sure. So there's a whole field of research around cross-language information retrieval. And that's really what we're talking about here when we were applying these taste translations, is that when people were doing searches, they're absolutely making use of the taste ontology that existed for the language that they were in. But you really, you know, in the instance of you, Max, you're, you know, an English speaker, and you, let's say you go to Japan, and you know, you type in, okay, I really want curry, so let me search for some curry, and you would get what I would call the tourist experience within Foursquare, because the results that you would get before we had these taste translation links is you would find tips that English users wrote about curry at various places. What you would not have access to would be all of the Japanese users who've written tips in Japanese about curry, and you just would have no access to that at all. And so once we actually have these translation links in place, we're able to walk across that graph and be able to, you know, increase the recall with which we're able to give search results for. So if you were to go to Santiago, Chile, for example, and search for lamb, you know, in the old world, you would have gotten maybe three or four results. In the new world, you search for lamb. You search for the English lamb, but then you also translate. You know, you get the translation, and you know to look for cordero within Santiago, and you get, you know, 60, 70 different results, all of which are, it's just a better experience for the user at the end of the day.
Yeah, I've experienced this personally, you know, when traveling abroad, and I think Mexico was a very good example where, you know, other recommender systems, other city guides would just return the tourist venues, but Foursquare would find kind of the local favorites that you're often looking for, and it would do a very good job. People would be, people are shocked. I don't know why people are so skeptical of me when I say, well, let's use Foursquare, but when I show them where Foursquare is pointing them, it never embarrasses me. So let's talk about doing these taste translations, because that's not always so easy, right? You think you have, okay, your taste graph in English, your taste graph in Spanish, one-to-one matching, right?
Well, I mean, language is hard, and you don't always have an exact one-to-one match on those tastes. That's one of the problems that we ran into, was trying to do that resolution across languages. So for the example that came to mind when we were talking about this before, is in Indonesian, they don't really have a word for bread other than roti. They use the word roti to refer to actual roti or actual, you know, white bread.
So what is roti? I don't even know what that is.
So roti is an Indonesian. In Indonesian, it's the Indonesian word for bread.
Okay.
There's like roti kanai. There is, and like the Caribbean has things called roti.
You're saying
roti.
It's something else also besides bread.
Well, no, there is a thing called roti. Like if we were to open up Google and search for roti, you would see like a flatbread, that you would break apart and dip in sauce with an Indonesian.
I see.
But here in English, you would actually call that type of bread roti, versus like sliced white bread would just be called bread.
I see. So it's actually a particular kind of bread in English, but they don't make a distinction.
Right. There's no distinction on their side. Okay. And so then, the question became, okay, how do we actually go about, referring to bread, in Indonesian. I think what we ended up selecting was we went with the local, like the typical local version of roti, and just mapping that to the English version, which was just the English roti. And so, like, I don't think there actually is a link between Indonesian. I don't think there's a link between English bread and anything in Indonesian.
Yes, that's really interesting. I'm always interested to see examples of that. Maybe we could put together a few for the show notes page.
Sure.
You have a few. Yeah, okay. Because understanding which languages have gaps or which languages have things that go together in one that don't necessarily go together in another, that's actually really interesting. Maybe like 5 years ago, I read this book called Through the Language Glass, which maybe I'll put in the show notes, which talks about this, where certain languages, you could almost express anything in any language ultimately, but certain languages kind of force you to express more than you need.
Yep. So for instance, I think in English, pepper, is really the only word that we have, versus in Spanish, I think there was like four or five different kinds of pepper, right. Four or five different words that could be used for pepper, and they meant slightly different things.
Right.
And we didn't necessarily want to equivalence those together, but it's just like, what do you translate them to? Like, you would just translate them all to pepper at the end of the day, even though they actually mean different things, within the local language. So it's not just a problem for Indonesian. It's a problem within English as well. I mean, it's a problem for every language. Like, you're going to have concepts that are just, underspecified, that another language just has more words for.
Yeah. Yeah. I've learned a whole lot about languages and different cultures and different, all the different intricacies that goes into this just by examining this system. So it's really been fascinating. All right, that's it for today. This is the part of the program where I let you plug anything you want. So do you have a website or a Twitter account or anything that you would like to send people to?
I'm real boring. All I really have is my Twitter account, but like, you should only follow me if you want to see me make, jokes about, politics or technology or,
That's like half the people listening to this show.
I don't have a podcast or anything that I'm trying to hawk on people.
All right, so. It's KJC9.
Yes.
All right, folks, remember that's KJC9 at KJC9. If you want to follow Chris Conception on Twitter, his Twitter account's pretty entertaining. I think, he shouldn't sell himself short. I also noticed that when I was recording this, yes, Marsbot was down, unfortunately, but we have successfully brought Marsbot back to life. What is Marsbot, you asked? I may have covered it on the program once or twice before, but Marsbot is Foursquare's kind of experimental app. It's an app that chats with you. You chat with it. It knows where you go, and it looks out for your interests. And it sort of tells you, it gives you little pieces of information as you move about the city or your hometown or when you're traveling. And by the way, Marsbot does use tastes. It makes very, very extensive use of tastes, in fact. So if you download Marsbot, every time you go into a restaurant or a bar, it'll tell you what to order. One time I was traveling in San Diego and it told me to get, I believe, the English muffin. And I was like, I'm not so sure. And then they told me, well, there's a regular bread that comes with this, or it's the English muffin. I'm like, well, I got to go with that. And you know what? It was delicious. It really was. Okay, so Marsbot will, it'll make your life a little bit better as you go, and give it a try. And it also asks you, on the first day, to list some tastes that you might like. So it knows how to personalize everything. Now, we got some shows, some good shows planned out next week. You're going to listen to my conversation with Christian Hubbs, who's the host of Artificially Intelligent. I've appeared on his program. He's appeared on on the Local Maximum for a few minutes in the past, just to describe what his program is on and to kind of tease out my appearance. But I'm going to talk to him about everything that he's covered and learned about artificial intelligence on Artificially Intelligent on his podcast. Or, well, maybe not everything he covered, but quite a bit. We're going to talk about how AI is going to affect how we work, which industries are going to be disrupted, and some thoughts on what the long-term implications of AI are. So a very interesting discussion, and you'll be listening to that next week. Now, another topic that I want to cover, and we kind of got into this very briefly last week, was the Twitter bot purge. I know that a lot of you who are on Twitter have noticed that they've been removing a lot of bots. You might have noticed that you lost some followers. I didn't lose any followers, but some people I know have said that they did. So I do want to talk about this maybe in 2 weeks from now, maybe a little bit after that. Is it working for you? Are you having a better experience? Is it annoying? Is it disrupting you in any way? Let me know. localmaxradio@gmail.com. I'd like to know your opinion and your feedback on this issue as I cover it, because this is a very difficult and I guess long range sort of play by Twitter, and it's kind of a never ending battle that they are fighting against the so-called bot armies. That's what's coming up in the next few weeks. Have a great week, everyone, and listen next week for the Local Maximum. Have a great week. That's the show. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you want to keep up, remember to follow the Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxClark. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
Don't care what you say, you're gonna see.